Hi, welcome back. I am sorry to make this a recorded session again, but this will be my last recorded session. Next week, I'll be back to live sessions. So I thought I'd go back to a page I kind of went over in my last session. I hope you had a chance to watch that recorded session. And I think I went over it too fast. The dogs were under my feet. I thought I heard Noah crying in the next room. So I was a little in a hurry. So I thought I'd go through this page one more time. So basically what I did in this page was estimate the cost of debt at the 30% debt ratio. So I've actually filled out, this is on page 49 of your slides if you're interested, and you can track along as I go through. I filled out exactly how I would do it. So at a 30% debt ratio, my debt to equity is 30 over 70, 42.86%. My dollar debt is 30% of the overall firm value. So basically the overall firm value was 131. So, you know, it's a 137, whatever, 1,000 that we estimated. 30% of that is 41,352. The EBITDA depreciation and EBIT remain unchanged. And remember why that is. The EBITDA depreciation and EBIT remain unchanged because when I borrow money, I don't take projects for that. Because if I did, that would affect my EBITDA depreciation and EBIT. I buy back stock or I pay a special dividend. And then I compute my interest expense. And here's where I ran into trouble. When I tried to compute the interest expense, I didn't have an interest rate yet for my dollar debt. So what I did was I used the interest rate from the 20% level, which I already knew, 3.15%. 3.15% of 41,352 is 1,302. You divide the 10,032 by 1,302, you get an interest coverage ratio of 7.7. Now, if you look back at the previous page, you'll see my interest coverage ratio at a 7.7 interest coverage ratio. I'm sorry, I am way out of sync here. At a 7.7 interest coverage ratio, my rating is AA. So I put in a AA rating and a 3.45% cost of debt. Going with that rate. Do you see what my problem is? The interest expense I computed with the 3.15% rate, but I'm ending the process by saying, no, I changed my mind. The interest rate should really be 3.45%. Now, do you see why I have this second column there? I go back and I recompute my interest expense with a 3.45% interest rate. That gives me 1,427. I recompute my interest coverage ratio. And then I very gingerly turn back to the previous page and hope that I stay within the same ratings class. And here I got lucky. I stayed 7.03. I'm still at a AA rating. Still 3.45% rate, the rates match up, I can move to the 40% debt ratio. So that's the iterative process. It requires two, sometimes three iterations to get there. And that is the way we get the cost of debt. If you remember, we found Disney's optimal debt ratio to be 40%. And in the last session, we talked about why we should do it. If you do it, your increase in value would be about 19 billion. That increase in value, 19 billion, is coming entirely from transferring wealth from taxpayers. It's a tax subsidy. So don't think of yourself as value creating in the glorious way of taking great projects and producing products. This is value creation. This is value transfer from taxpayers. Again, nothing, I'm not passing a moral judgment on it, but that's where the increase in value is coming from. And we closed the loop by looking at how much we'd be willing to pay for shares. And I think we came up with this break-even price, if you remember, of 78.61. Let me repeat again why that's a break-even price. If I pay 78.61 for the shares I buy back, everybody in the company gets an equal share of the increase in value in the company. The people who sell their shares back and the people who remain in the company. If I pay lower than 78.61, if you remember, I tried the 67.71, the people who sell back obviously get none of the increase in value, and the people who stay in the company get a much bigger increase in value, making their stock price go up. But if you think of mistakes that companies make, it's usually not that they pay too little for their buybacks, it's that they pay too much. If I paid $85 or $90 per share on my buyback, then obviously the people who sell their shares back will get a much bigger chunk of the increase in value. And the people left behind will get far less. No, their stock price will be less than $78.61. So the question of why should we do it? The answer is your value will increase by more than 19 billion. And if you buy back shares, your stock price is going to jump to about $79 per share, even in a rational setup. Now let's ask the question, what if something goes wrong? If you ever optimize the capital structure for a company and the management of the company asks, what if something goes wrong? The one answer you should never give them is, nothing will go wrong. Because the minute you say that, something will go wrong. So there are two ways you can do you can look to see how sensitive your optimal is to changes in your assumptions. The first is you can ask what if questions about your operating income. The operating income is the key number driving your optimal. This is a very earnings driven approach to how much can you borrow money. So you can ask what will happen if my operating income drops by 10%, 20%, 30%, and just to see how sensitive your conclusions are. The second and more intuitive approach is ask is to actually be explicit about what can go wrong. What do I mean by that? If you're a cyclical firm, what are you worried about? A recession. If you're a company that gets a bulk of your revenues from defense contracts, what you're worried about is that you'd lose one of those contracts. So you're going to basically ask, what will happen if there's a recession or I lose a contract? Work through the numbers and see what the optimal looks like. So that's one way to deal with downside risk, is to take the operating income and play with it, see what happens to your optimal. The other is to actually impose a constraint on your analysis. And let me explain what I mean by that. I said the optimal debt ratio for your company is that debt ratio that minimizes your cost of capital, right? But when I did that, I'd never asked the question, what rating will my company have? So your cost of capital could have been minimized at a B rating, and I'd have asked you to go to that optimal debt ratio. And that doesn't make any sense. Most companies have a rating constraint. They do not want to drop below a rating. The most common is investment grade. You don't want to drop below investment grade. We're going to talk about how to impose a ratings constraint when you do a cost of capital analysis, because that will allow you to minimize your cost of capital without exposing yourself to dangerous amounts of default risk. So let's start with the first of those two things with Disney. Remember, Disney's optimal is 40%, and I'm trying to ask what will happen to Disney. How sensitive is Disney's optimal to Disney having a bad year? Now, to figure out what a bad year will look like for Disney, I looked at its history. Now, we know in a bad year, your earnings will drop. But by looking at its history, you can see how bad the drop is and try to build into your analysis. So here I have about 25 years of data. I've computed the percentage change in operating income every year, and I'm looking at that column of percentage change. The worst year that Disney had in the previous 26 years was a minus 29% year in 2000. So to me, a bad year for Disney would be about a terrible year, would be about a 30% drop in operating income. A more common year would be probably 10, 15, 20%. Now, when you do this for your company, the company in your project, your company might be like Con Ed. A bad year for it might be only a 5% drop in operating income. Or it could be a tech company where a bad year could be a 40% drop in operating income. So what I'm looking for here is, what does a bad year look like for my company? I also looked at four recessions and looked to see how much Disney's operating income dropped in each one. In the 2009 recession, their operating income dropped by 23%. That was a pretty severe recession. 2002, it dropped by 16%. 1991, it dropped by 22%. 81, 82, it actually increased. But during a recession, it looks like Disney's operating income drops about 20 to 25%. So I now have the ammunition to take my operating income and decrease it and see what happens to my optimal. Remember, really bad year for Disney is about a 25 to 30% drop in operating income. It looks like, I took my optimal capital structure spreadsheet and changed only the operating income. Drops 10%, 20%, 30%. Hey, you know what? My optimal stays where it is until the operating income drops by 40%. Remember, we said a bad year for Disney is about a 30% drop. You know how I'd use this? If I presented the optimal debt ratio to Disney and said, what if we have a bad year? My response is, you have enough buffer built in that even with a bad year, you're not going to be in trouble with a 40% debt ratio. For some companies, though, when you do this what if, you might very quickly see your optimal go from 40 to 20 with a 10% drop, and a bad year for them is 30%. When they say, look, we don't want to borrow money because a bad year could put us under, you should step back and say, you're right, you shouldn't borrow money. Nobody gains anything by forcing companies to borrow money and see them get into default trouble in the year after, 2 years after, or 3 years after. So that's one way, is to take the operating income and look at what if questions around the operating income. The second way to bring this into the analysis is specify rating below which you do not want to fall. The most common constraint you will find at companies, especially non-financial service companies, is investment grade. You don't want to drop below investment grade. There's a reason for that. prior to the 1980s, in fact, if you're below investment grade, you could not issue, original issue bonds were almost unheard of by companies with below investment grade ratings. Mike Milken and Drexel Burnham changed that, but it's still much more difficult for a company with below investment grade ratings to go out and raise capital. And when they do raise capital, it tends to cost them more. They're more capital constraints. So when companies say, "Look, I want at least an investment grade rating," it makes sense. But once in a while, you will get a company imposing a completely unrealistic rating constraint. They'd say, "Look, I want to be a AAA rated company at any cost." You know what? Rise to the challenge. Give them the bill. Tell them how much it'll cost them to be a AAA rated company. And you will see very quickly that the cost of a ratings constraint will depend on how severe the rating constraint is. In fact, let me use this on Disney so you can see how this would work out. When I told you Disney's optimal debt ratio was 40%, the rating for Disney at a 40% at a 40% optimal debt ratio is single A. So that's a pretty good rating. But let's say Disney came back and say, "We want at least a double A rating." Well, here's how you'd build it into your analysis. With a double A rating, the most Disney can afford to borrow is 30%, because it goes from 30 to 40, its rating drops below double A. Its value at a 40% debt ratio was $153.53 billion. At a 30% debt ratio, that value would have been $147.8 billion. The difference between those two numbers, $5.7 billion, is the cost of a AA rating constraint. And you know what? Disney might say, "Look, we're willing to pay that price to have a AA rating." If Disney had imposed a AAA rating, the value that they'd have had at a AAA rating, because the most they could have borrowed would been only 20%, would have been $141.4 billion. You subtract that from the 153.5, which is the unconstrained value, the cost of a AAA rating constraint is $12.12 billion. Sometimes imposing an unrealistically high ratings constraint means you're leaving money on the table, and it's not your money, it's your shareholders' money. And you have to explain to them why the value of having a AAA rating is such that you're willing to give up $12 billion to get that rating. So why should we do it? About $19 billion in increased value, mostly from taxpayer subsidies. What if something goes wrong? At least in the case of Disney, they have enough buffer in their operating income that even if something goes wrong, they should be okay. And they have a bad year. And their rating is single A, even at a 40% optimal. It's not double B or single B. So I ask a final question. What if we don't want to buy back stock? Because remember, implicitly in the approach I described last session, the way you increase the debt ratio is you borrowed money and you bought back stock. You say, "What if I don't want to buy back stock? Why? Maybe I have other projects I need to take, big plans to build a new theme park in Shanghai, expand ESPN, and I need money to do it. It seems silly to go out and borrow money and buy back stock and then raise fresh capital to take those investments." So Disney asks you a question. Will our optimal be different if instead, remember the optimal of 40%, if instead of buying back stocks, we invested in projects instead? Well, I'll give you the easy answer. No, as long as you stay in the same businesses, you're building more theme parks, making more movies, expanding broadcasting, the 40% will travel. Why? Because you'll just scale up as a company and your cash flows will scale up with you. But if you're planning to borrow money to buy Twitter or Tesla, all bets are off. Because then you're buying a young money-losing company, and that's going to change your optimal debt ratio. What this effectively means is if a company says, "Look, we have excess debt capacity, can I go do whatever I want?" The answer is to be no. Tell me what you plan to do, and I'll work out the effects on your optimal debt ratio, but I cannot give you a blank check. So why should we do it? Take change in value, work out if you want to buy back stock, what it'll mean in terms of increased stock prices. What if something goes wrong? Do the what if on the EBIT, put a rating constraint. And can I, instead of buying back stock, take projects instead? The answer is yes, if you stay in the same business. There's another twist on when you might not be able to buy back stock. As some of you have been if you've been reading the news stories on the bailouts that are being planned, you know that one of the conditions that are being imposed on companies that accept these bailouts is they might be restricted or barred from buying back stock, at least for the period that they still owe money to the US government. I think that's a perfectly legitimate constraint to impose. But let's say you're a company that's been restrained from doing buybacks. There's some countries in the world where you can't do buybacks and you want to do a recapitalization. In other words, you want to borrow money and reduce equity. If you can't buy back stock, is there a different approach you can use to accomplish the same objective? You've raised debt, you want lower equity, you can't buy back stock. You know what else you can do? You can pay a special dividend. So if you can't buy back stock, you can still, you know, recapitalize by paying a special dividend. So that was the Disney approach. We've carried in its full detail. On my next three or four companies, I'm going to give you just the final table because I don't want to torture you by taking through the same process. So the process is basically the same. With each of these companies, though, I'm going to focus in on a couple of things in this company that make it different from Disney and how I dealt with it. Let's start with Tata Motors, right? So I computed the optimal debt ratio for Tata Motors and the same approach. As my debt ratio goes up, I compute the levered beta. The levered beta goes up, my cost of equity goes up. At each debt ratio, I also compute the interest coverage ratio and rating. So you see my ratings go from AAA down to single C and the interest rate on my debt. My tax rate stays at 32.45% till I get to 50% debt, but then my interest expense gets too high relative to my operating income. Remember how I lost tax benefits with Disney, and my tax rate decreases. My after-tax cost of debt reflects both the rising interest rate and the loss in tax benefits at higher debt ratios. In the second last column, I have the cost of capital for Tata Motors. And you look, initially decreases, it bottoms out at about 20% debt, and then it goes up. The optimal debt ratio for Tata Motors, if you look at minimizing cost of capital, is 20% debt. They were actually at 29%. They had too much debt. Now, with Tata, with the Tata Group, I actually did this optimal for Tata Motors, Tata Steel, and Tata Chemicals, and they were all over levered. They had too much debt relative to their optimal. And then I did Tata Consulting Services, the largest and most successful of the Tata companies, and it was under levered significantly. Its debt ratio was close to 0%. It's optimal is 20%. Now, this might be my cynical side speaking, but it looks to me like the Tata Group is borrowing money for Tata Steel, Tata Motors, and Tata Chemicals, and banks are lending them money based not on their capacity to borrow money, but Tata Consulting Services. You think that is absurd. Why would a bank lend to a company based on some other company's credit standing? Because they're all part of the Tata Group. And what banks are assuming is if one of the companies gets into trouble, the Tata Group will step in and bail the company out. Might be a false premise, but you can see already that when you're part of a group, sometimes individual companies, you might look at the company and say, why is it doing what it is? You got to look at the group to get a sense of why the company is behaving the way it is. So Tata Motors is over-levered, but perhaps it's because it's part of a family group and the family group is determining debt ratios for the individual companies. The second stop I made was with Vale. I computed the optimal debt ratio for Vale following the same process. And beta increases, rating drops, my cost of capital decreases initially, bottoms out at about 30%, maybe between 30 and 40% debt. Vale's actual debt ratio was about 35%, which put it very close to where it should be, perhaps a little over levered. In fact, when I sent this analysis to one of my students who actually works pretty high up in the finance group at Vale, and he sent back a response saying, don't worry, we're actually under levered. So what do you mean? He said, well, our operating income was low last year because iron ore prices were low. But if we normalize iron ore prices, we take the average operating income over time, with that average operating income, our optimal is 50%. And actually what he's saying is not uncommon for commodity and natural resource companies. Their debt capacity is based upon not what they make in a specific year, but based on what normalized prices are for oil or steel or iron ore or copper or whatever the commodity is. So basically at their existing operating income, it looks like they're slightly over-levered. But if you cut them some slack and say, maybe iron ore prices will go back up, well, it looks like they're under-levered. In hindsight, no, iron ore prices did not go up. And one of the dangers of borrowing against a normalized price is normal is in the eye of the beholder. What if your prices don't normalize in the near term? You could go bankrupt before they eventually normalize. Now let's talk about Baidu. Young growth company, can I use it? Yeah, sure, I can do an optimal debt ratio like any other company. But what I find for Baidu is its optimal debt ratio is only 10%. You say, why is it so low? In a moment, we're going to see what causes these companies to have different optimals, because already you can see Disney's optimal is 40%, Vale's optimal was 30%, Tata Motors was 20%, and Baidu's is 10%. So their optimal is 10%. They were actually at a 5% debt ratio, which puts them pretty close to their optimal. Already you can see for different companies, you get different optimal debt ratios. Finally, I looked at my private company. One of the limitations of trying to do this in a private company is the numbers I start with are market numbers, right? I start with the market value of Disney as a company, and I don't have that for Bookscape. So I cheated. Here's how I got their market value. I took their net income and I took the price earnings ratio for publicly traded book retailers, so about 20. 20 times their net income gives me a value of equity of 31 and a half million. I made that my market value of equity. I did my entire analysis using that combined value, 12.1 million. It says 12,136 is actually 12.136 million and 31.5 million. So basically my debt ratio right now is 27.81%. I tried to compute their optimal. As their debt ratio went from 0 to 90%, I looked at the total beta. Remember my argument for using total beta here. It's a private company. The owner is not diversified. The cost of equity should be based on the total beta. So there's my total beta going up as my debt ratio goes up. My cost of debt is going up because my rating decreases. You see my cost of capital decreases, minimized at the 30% debt ratio, and then it starts climbing again. The optimal debt ratio for Bookscape is about 30% debt. At 27.8% debt, Bookscape looks like it's pretty close to its optimal debt ratio. So those were my analyses for my five non-financial service companies. In a few minutes, I'll come back and talk about Deutsche Bank, the financial service company, and why the way you frame the question would have to be different for Deutsche. Now, one of the things I want to emphasize about these companies is, or especially with my US companies, the rules have changed after the 2017 Tax Reform Act. That act lowered the marginal tax rate for US companies from 35 to 21%. That's a big drop in the tax benefits of debt. It also put a limit on how much you can deduct for taxes in terms of interest expenses. It capped the interest expenses at 30% of EBITDA. So if your interest expenses exceed 30% of EBITDA, you no longer get the tax benefit. Put simply, that 2017 Tax Reform Act has reduced the tax benefit of debt substantially. Let me ask you a question. Given that that's happened, what should you expect to see happen to the dollar debt at US companies in 2018 and 2019? I've taken away a big chunk of your benefits, right? I actually first looked to see what would happen when I did my optimal capital structure. And I used Disney in 2018 to illustrate the effect of the change in the tax law. Initially, I looked for the optimal capital structure for Disney using the old tax law, 40% tax rate, no restrictions in interest. My optimal debt ratio was 50%, but you see the orange line? That's how much my value increases. My value at 50% is almost $60 billion higher than my value is at 0%. Then I did my optimal debt ratio, changing the tax rate from 40% down to 25%. Which is like the consolidated federal and state tax. My optimal is still 50%, which surprised me. I expected the optimal to drop. But look at how much less my firm value is at a 50% debt ratio. Look at the difference between those three numbers. You know what that difference is? That's how much less US taxpayers are subsidizing Disney at a 50% debt ratio. That's why I said the 2017 Tax Reform Act, fundamentally, what it did for corporate taxes, at least, was good because it reduced the tax benefit of debt. And by doing so, it reduces the subsidy that taxpayers are giving to highly indebted firms. But the optimal for Disney remained the same. But for many of the companies in my sample, when I changed from the old tax code to the new one, the optimal dropped pretty significantly. I then looked at US companies to see if they were lowering debt after the Tax Reform Act. And I was a little disappointed by what I saw. See the blue and the green line. The blue is actually total interest bearing debt. The green includes leases. I was expecting the numbers in 2018 and 19, so the dollar value of debt to be lower, but it wasn't. In fact, it rose a little bit in 2018 and even more in 2019. I know you'll hear all kinds of cockamamie reasons for that. Interest rates were low. Well, interest rates are low. Cost of equity and the cost of debt are low. In fact, I think the only way you can explain this is by arguing that companies operate on inertia, that they borrow money the way they always have. Nobody's stopping and asking the question, does it still make sense to borrow money? The only defense that these companies might offer is as a multiple of EBITDA. Now, debt is lower. That might be true, but that's not a really good argument. I would expect debt values to decrease. And maybe, if nothing else, one of the consequences of this crisis might be a revisiting of companies to, should we be borrowing money? Does this make sense? Now, as you look at the cost of capital approach, it comes with some limitations. And let me draw your attention to some of those limitations. All I did was minimize my cost of capital, right? Arguing that my numerator was unaffected. My numerator is my operating income. In a sense, I'm just keeping the operating income fixed as my debt ratio goes from 20 to 30 to 50 to 80 to 90%. You're saying, what's the big deal? It's operating income. Remember, as my debt ratio goes from 20 to 30 to 50 to 90%, my rating is dropping. As my rating is dropping, people are getting more and more worried about my survival. My customers stop buying my products. My suppliers demand cash. Do you see what I'm saying? My operating income is likely to decrease if my rating drops to single B or triple C. And I'm not factoring that in when I do the traditional cost of capital approach. It's also static. I'm basing my cost of ca my optimal debt ratio on the operating income in the most recent year. And finally, I'm making some rigid assumptions about how the beta will change. I'm assuming that all of the market risk in the company is borne by the beta, the levered beta calculation. Is there a way around this? Yes, there's an approach called the enhanced cost of capital approach. And there are two things you can do in the enhanced cost of capital approach. One is, instead of keeping the operating income fixed as the debt ratio changes and the rating changes, you can adjust the operating income to the rating. So as the rating decreases, maybe the operating income should get lower. So I'm going to bring that in. The second is, maybe instead of keeping the operating income a fixed number, you can allow it to become a dynamic number. Remember those Monte Carlo simulations? You can put a Monte Carlo simulation on top of your optimal capital structure. I know it sounds messy, but here's how it would work out. Let's go back and review what we did for Disney. In my original analysis for Disney, where I came up with the optimal of 40%, as my debt ratio went down and my rating dropped, my EBITDA and EBIT stayed the same. In this enhanced approach, here's what I'm going to do. If Disney's rating is double A or triple A, I'm going to leave the operating income as is. But as Disney's rating decreases, I'm going to drop the EBITDA, arguing that as my rating dropped, people worry about survival, I have less revenues and lower operating income. And I looked at three possible scenarios. One was a low indirect bankruptcy cost. Remember, indirect bankruptcy costs are how much people perceive trouble in your company and how much it affects their actions, medium and high. If I use the high scenario, if I drop to a single A rating, I lose 2% of my EBITDA. If I drop to an A minus, I drop 5%. Go to triple B, I lost 15%. You say, where are you getting these drops? I actually looked at companies that had been downgraded in previous years and what happened to their EBITDA in the following year. It's not a precise number. There's a subjective judgment. But if Disney drops to a triple B rated company, I'm assuming their EBITDA will drop by 15%. Now you see what this is going to do? As I change my debt ratio, my cost of capital will change for the same reasons it did in the original approach. But as I change my debt ratio, I'm also going to check my rating. And if my rating starts dropping, I've got to adjust my operating income. You're saying, what does that all mean? Both my numerator and my denominator are changing, which means my value as a company is what I need to focus on. I can no longer just look at the lowest cost of capital. It might not be my optimal. I have to look at where my value as a company is maximized. So here's what I got for Disney with the EBITDA change built in. My optimal stayed at 50%. I got lucky. For most companies, when you put in distress costs, the optimal will decrease. My optimal stayed at 50%. I gave Disney the medium bankruptcy cost. If I'd given them high bankruptcy costs, their optimal would have dropped about 20%. With medium bankruptcy costs, their optimal stays at 50%. But look at how off the cliff they fall if they go beyond, I'm sorry, at 40% was the optimal. Look at how much off the cliff they go if their optimal, if they increase their debt ratio to 50, 60. Basically, it creates a vicious spiral. The rating drops below triple B, their EBITDA drops, the EBITDA drops causes their rating to drop even further. And you want to avoid this debt spiral of your company. And that's why you want to stay as far as you can from that 40%. So if I were advising Disney, I'd probably say, hold back, go back, go to 20 or 30% debt, but don't go to 40. You're too close to the edge. Now let me close this optimal debt ratio process by talking about the final company in my group, which is Deutsche. Now, with banks, you can't ask what the optimal debt ratio is. And the reason is simple. Debt for a bank is not source of capital, it's raw material. So with the debt with a bank or an investment bank or an insurance company, the question I'm going to ask is, does my company have too little equity? Not too much debt, but too little equity. You see, what does that mean? With financial service companies, book equity actually has meaning because it becomes a basis for regulatory capital. So if my bank has too little regulatory capital, it's going to get in trouble. The regulatory authorities will force it to either raise capital or shut it down. So I'm going to argue that I can look at a bank and ask, how much equity capital does it have? Does it have too little or too much? Because that's the question you need to ask when you think about the financing principle with a bank. So rather than talk in abstractions, let me use a very simple bank. This is a traditional old-fashioned bank. It takes deposits, it makes loans. It has $100 million in loans outstanding. It has book equity of about 6 million. So right now its regulatory capital ratio is about 6%. Let's assume that the minimum is only 5%. So it's above the minimum right now, but the people running this bank are conservative. They want to raise the equity capital ratio to 7%. And they want to increase the loans they're going to give out next year to 150 million. So here's a question I want to answer. How much equity will this bank need to have next year? So next year, I will have 150 million in loans. 7% of 150 is 10.5 million. I have 6 million, so I need an extra 4.5 million in new equity. Let me ask you a question. What is the least painful way of raising new equity? Or retained earnings, right? So let's say next year this company has 3 million in net income. What should it do? It should take the 3 million and set it to cover the 4.5 million. It still needs an extra 1.5 million. It'll have to raise 1.5 million in new equity. Now, do you see why dividend policy can get in the way? If you take 3 million that you have in net income and pay out 2 million of that in dividends, you have only 1 million in retained earnings, then you'll have to raise 3.5 million in new equity. So once I get this new equity, I'll have to figure out how much net income this bank will have and how much it plans to pay in dividends, and then tell the bank how much additional equity it might have to raise. So with banks, rather than ask the question, do I have too much debt or too little debt? The question you've got to ask is, do I have too much equity or too little equity? And for once, you're talking about book equity. Now let's try this on Deutsche. In 2013, Deutsche was already in trouble, though not the basket case had become in 2016 or in 2020. It was losing money at $716 million in euros in losses. Its tier one capital ratio dropped to 15.13%, and the bank had stated a target of 18%. And it had risk-adjusted assets, a very bank-centric way of measuring assets, the regulatory measure of assets, of about $440 billion. So here's what I've done. I've projected out what will happen to the asset base over time, giving Deutsche a fairly low growth rate. And I've assumed over time that Deutsche is going to try to move its tier one capital ratio from 15.13 to 18%. As the tier one capital ratio goes up, each year I get a much higher tier one capital. You're saying, what am I going to do with this? Take year one. My tier one capital has to go from 66,561 to 71,156. Deutsche needs 4,595 million in new regulatory capital next year in a change in book value. It's going to have only 602 million in net income. That's based on my projections. If it doesn't pay a dividend, and I would advise it not to pay a dividend, you can take the 602 million, use it to cover some of that 4,595, but it still have to raise 3,993 million in new equity next year. The year after that, its income will improve even more to 2.2 million, but it'll still need an extra 2.6 billion euros to get to stay. So you can see that it's going to have to raise equity for the next 3 years. And starting in year four, it will have enough cash that if it wants to pay a dividend, it now can. We're going to use this framework later to talk about dividend policy, but notice how our frame of reference changes when you go from looking at a non-financial service company to a financial service company. The question becomes not, do you have too much debt, but do you have enough equity? So with a financial institution, there are three basic strategies you can adopt. One is you can play the dangerous game. What's a dangerous game? You look at what the regulators are demanding as a minimum ratio, and you try to stay as close as you can to that minimum. And you even try to find loopholes so that you can get away with holding even less capital. Some banks seem to think this is a game between them and the regulators, and they try to minimize the regulatory capital, which is silly, because if you look across time, banks predate regulatory authorities. The Rothschilds ran a bank for hundreds of years before there were regulatory authorities. You know how they survived? They set aside enough capital to cover losses from bad times because they knew bad times would come. That is the genesis for regulatory capital. I call it the self-regulatory strategy, where a bank looks at the risk of its investments and sets aside enough capital to cover those losses. Now, most of today's banks adopt a combination. They look at the regulatory minimum because they have to meet the regulatory ratios, but they also try to bring in their own decisions on how much capital to carry. That's why you can have conservative banks and aggressive banks in terms of playing the regulatory capital game. So that's a financing decision for a bank. Now let me go back to my optimal debt ratios and talk a little bit about why the optimals were different for my companies. You remember the optimal debt ratio I got for Disney was 40%, for Vale was 30%, Tata Motors was 20%, for Bookscape was 10%. Why different for different companies? Or Baidu was 10%, Bookscape was 30% again. Why the debt ratio is different? Well, here's one easy answer. It depends on your tax rate. Remember, the biggest and really the only substantial benefit of debt is a tax benefit. I took all five of my companies, kept every number as is, and just lowered my marginal tax rate, or raised it in some cases, 0 to 50%. At a 50% tax rate, basically, I get pretty high optimal debt ratio. In fact, Vale's optimal jumped from 30 to 40%. But at a 0% tax rate, look at what happens to the optimal debt ratio for every company. For every company, the optimal debt ratio is 0%. In fact, I'll make it as a categorical statement. If you get no tax benefits from debt, debt can only increase your cost of capital. It cannot decrease it, no matter how cheap it looks. It sounds like an absurdity that I'm overreaching, but the tax benefits of debt are what make it attractive. So what does this mean? If you're a cruise line company where you never pay taxes, or a Middle Eastern company that doesn't have a tax benefit from debt, you shouldn't borrow money. And if you do, then you've got some other motive. It might be control, it might be bridge financing. But the first and biggest factor driving your optimal debt ratio is what's your marginal tax rate. Here's the second factor. Tell me how much you have in cash flows. Earlier, I described my optimal debt ratio approach as one that's focused on operating income. The more you have in operating income or its close relative in EBITDA, relative to your market value as a company, the higher your optimal will be. In fact, here's what I've done. I've taken the EBITDA as a percentage of enterprise value and EBIT as a percent of enterprise value. The higher this ratio is, the higher your optimal should be. Now, so if you compare Disney to Baidu, Disney has a much higher EBITDA as a percentage of EV to Baidu. This is a much higher optimum. You say, how do you explain Vale, which has an even higher EBITDA? It also happens to be an emerging market company, which pushes in the other direction. So the second factor that drives your optimal debt ratio is how much cash flow do you have as a firm relative to the enterprise value. For those of you working with growth companies, don't be surprised to see an optimal debt ratio of 10% or even 0%, precisely for this reason. Because 10% of a very high market value might be so much debt, you can't afford it as a young growth company. Third, there's risk. Now, at the risk of stating the obvious, the riskier you are as a company, the less you should borrow. And it shows up in two places in your optimal debt ratio calculation. First is, if you're in a risky business, you'll have a higher unlevered beta. If you have a higher unlevered beta, the multiplier effect of borrowing money will be much greater. So companies with high unlevered beta should have lower optimal debt ratios. And the second place it'll show up is in the rating that I give your company at any debt ratio. I've actually used a lookup table, but if you're a risky company, ratings agency are probably going to give you a lower rating for any given interest coverage ratio. So those factors are going to keep your optimal down. So three company specific factors. What's your tax rate? How much do you generate in cash flows? How risky are you? There's only one macro variable that seems to drive the optimal debt ratio choice. And that macro variable is, what's the price of risk in the equity market versus the price of risk in the bond market? And you react to me, what are you talking about? Remember the equity risk premium? The equity risk premium, this red line, is the price of risk in the equity market. This black line is the default spread. That's the price of risk in the bond market. Think like a CFO. You want to go to the market where the price of risk is lowest because you're getting the best deal for your money. So if you take, for instance, the 1990s, take a look at what's happening to equity risk premiums. They're actually dropping, and the equity markets are charging almost nothing for risk. So guess what? In the late 90s, if you wanted to raise capital as a company, you wanted to use mostly equity because equity was costing you almost nothing. You go 7 or 8 years later, this is the Greenspan put where Alan Greenspan, after 9/11, said, I'm not going to let the U.S. economy get into recession. The way this showed up was in default spreads dropping dramatically while equity risk premiums stayed high. In 2006, if you're a company going out to raise money, guess what? You'd much rather raise it in the form of debt than equity. It was a golden age of leveraged buyouts. Then you got the 2008 crisis, zigging and zagging. But notice what's been happening for the last 2 or 3 years. Default spreads have been decreasing, but equity risk premiums have stayed high. In 2019, I think a lot of companies were borrowing money because they were trying to take advantage of what they saw as the low price of risk in the bond market relative to the equity market. Well, they're paying a cost for that now in the crisis. But you can see that the price of risk in markets has consequences. Here's what I'd like you to do. I know there's another nag for your project, but you know, might as well nag you again. Go back and pick your company. I sent you a link to an Excel spreadsheet after the Monday class. Open that spreadsheet. There are about a dozen inputs I want you to enter for your company. And when you enter those dozen inputs, the spreadsheet will do the magic for you. It'll compute the optimal debt. It'll do everything I did for Disney. It'll do for your company. It'll compute the optimal debt ratio. It'll tell you the cost of capital at the optimal. It'll tell you how much that change in the cost of capital will change your firm value and how much your stock price will be affected, assuming investors are rational. So it'll use that simple solution. And in terms of mechanics, remember when you run that spreadsheet and it tells you your optimal is 30, 40, 50% and gives you a dollar debt, it's built on the presumption that you can borrow that money and buy back stock. So if your company is the kind of company that's not allowed to buy back stock or does not want to buy back stock, dot that I as well and tell me what you would do to get to the optimum. Now, incidentally, we're so focused on minimizing cost of capital. This just as a reminder, there's nothing to do with this discussion. Just as a reminder, you're not rewarded for just having a lower cost of capital. You've got to have a return on capital that exceeds the cost of capital. This is my 2017 table, but you got the 2020 table earlier in these lecture notes, where you saw how difficult it is for companies to earn more than the cost of capital. So while you're focused on lowering your cost of capital, remember that low cost of capital can be used to take projects only if you earn a return on capital higher than the cost of capital. Let's move to a third approach. So we've talked about the cost of capital approach, the enhanced cost of capital approach. Let's talk about the APV approach to coming up with an optimal debt ratio. In the APV approach, here's what you do. Rather than look for the point at which your cost of capital is minimized, you approach it differently. In fact, there are some business schools where you're taught only this approach and told that the cost of capital approach is faulty. I'm going to argue that many of the people who claim to use the APV approach are doing a half-assed job of actually putting it into practice, and I'll talk about why. But let's look at what the APV approach does. And so trying to minimize the cost of capital, here's what I do. I take a dollar debt that you have, and I first compute what the value of your company would be if you had no debt. That's called the unlevered firm value. Then I take the dollar debt that you're planning to borrow, and I compute the tax benefits on that debt. Remember, interest is tax deductible, and I can compute the tax benefits. I compute the dollar tax benefits. Then I also compute the expected bankruptcy costs I create for myself from that debt. My firm value, my levered firm value, will be my unlevered firm value plus the tax benefits of debt minus the expected bankruptcy costs. I compute my levered firm value at every dollar debt level, and I pick the one that maximizes my firm value. So I'm trying to do the same thing I did with the cost of capital approach. I'm just taking a different tack. Now, let's see what I'd need to put this into practice for a company. First, I need an unlevered firm value, and there are two ways you can get this. Here's the long way. You can do a full-fledged valuation. If you say, I've never done a valuation, it's not that big a deal. You project out the cash flows of the firm, and you discount back at your unlevered cost of equity. You say, what? Remember, if you're an unlevered firm, you have only equity. You're 100% equity. If you're 100% equity, your unlevered beta is also your levered beta. It's your cost of equity. And that cost of equity is also your cost of capital. So I discount your cash flows to the firm at a cost of capital that's equal to your cost of equity. I come up with an unlevered value. That's a lot of work though, right? So I'll give you a shortcut. Instead, you can start with the market value of the firm today with the debt and then take out the effects of the debt. By doing what? By subtracting out the tax benefits you're getting from your existing debt and adding back the bankruptcy cost you created for yourself by borrowing that money. You're reversing the effects of the debt. So that's the first step, getting an unlevered firm value. Is that difficult to do? Well, it's a little messy, but you can get there. Estimating the tax benefits of debt, the long way of doing it, you compute the interest expense each year and you compute the tax savings. What does that mean? You have $100 million in interest expenses next year and your tax rate is 25%. 25% of $100 million is $25 million. That's your tax saving next year. Then you do year two, year three, year four, and you take the present value of those savings. Let me give you a shortcut that works relatively well. If you assume your tax savings are perpetual, in other words, your debt is here to stay, then here's what you can do. You can take the total dollar debt rather than just the interest expense and multiply by the tax rate. So if you borrowed $1 billion, you can multiply the billion by the 25% tax rate and you get $250 million. That's your tax benefits. It's a shortcut. I mean, you are making some assumptions, but the assumptions are not unreasonable. So it's relatively easy to get the unlevered firm value. It's really easy to get the tax benefits of debt. Let's look at step three. To get the expected bankruptcy cost, I need two numbers. I need a probability of bankruptcy at every debt level. And then I need a cost of bankruptcy. Remember, we talked about direct and indirect costs. I need a cost as a percentage of the value of the firm. And here's where people get stuck. Many of the people who claim to use APB, and you will run into them once you get out there, and there are people who believe the APB. They say, I use the APB approach. I went to the University of Chicago and they taught me the APB approach is the only one to use. Make them dig their own, I was going to say graves, but that sounds too morbid. Make them create their own, set them up. And here's what you should do. Ask them to tell you what they do. They'll go through this long, detailed process of how they compute the unlevered firm value. Say, okay, I get that. Then they'll give you this long, detailed process of getting the tax benefits of debt. So you get that. Then they'll get to step three and say, you know what, it's too difficult to estimate expected bankruptcy costs, so I'm just going to ignore it. In practice, the APB approach is half-assed because here's what people do. They estimate an unlevered firm value. They add the tax benefits of debt. They ignore the expected bankruptcy costs. Think about it. If all I do is add the good stuff that comes from debt and I don't include the bad stuff, what's my optimal debt ratio going to be? In the half-assed APB approach, the optimal debt ratio for every firm is going to be 99.99% debt. So if you're going to use the APB approach, at least do it right. So for that person who tried to get you to believe that the APB approach was the only one to do and then did this half-assed job, show them what they need to do. They need to compute an expected bankruptcy cost. And to do this, they need two numbers. They need a probability of bankruptcy at every level of debt. And we're going to come up with a way of doing it, which builds on something we already did when we computed the cost of capital at every debt ratio. Remember we computed a synthetic rating at every debt ratio? We're going to use that synthetic rating to get a probability of bankruptcy at every debt ratio. So when I'm done, I'm going to have a probability of bankruptcy at every debt ratio. And then for the cost of bankruptcy, I'm going to do some hand waving. The direct bankruptcy cost is relatively simple. It's about 5 to 10% of value. So these are the legal costs associated after you go bankrupt. The indirect bankruptcy cost is much tougher. It ranges anywhere from close to 0%, if you're a grocery store maybe, to maybe 30 to 40%. If you're an airplane manufacturer, where customers stop buying your products if they think you're in trouble. So 0 to 30%, and you got to figure out where your company falls in the middle. So let's try this for Disney. But before I do this, let me show you how I'm going to compute, convert a rating that I'm estimating into a probability of default. I draw on a study that Ed Altman, who teaches at Stern, updates every year, where he looks at the likelihood of default for different rating classes in the 10 years following a bond issue. So for instance, when you look at AAA rated bonds and you track them for 10 years, only 0.07% default over those 10 years. As you go to BBB over the next 10 years, 7.5% default. You go to B minus, about 45% default. You give me your rating as a company, I'll tell you the probability of default. So at every debt level, I'm going to compute a synthetic rating and compute a probability of default. So I'm going to try this on Disney. So I'm going to first come up with the unlevered firm value, and I'm going to use the shortcut. I'm going to start with the market value of the firm, which incorporates $15.96 billion in debt. And then I'm going to remove the effects of that debt. Remember, if I were an all-equity funded firm, I wouldn't have the $15.96 billion in debt, which means I lose the tax benefit on that. So I'm multiplying the tax rate by that. That the 5,762 is the tax benefits I'm getting now with the debt. I'm going to remove that from the game. Right now, because I borrowed the money, there's a 0.66% chance of bankruptcy. Saying why 0.66%? Their current rating is single A. And if you go back and look at the table, single A rated bonds had a 0.66% probability of bankruptcy. 0.66%. I estimated a 25% bankruptcy cost. Remember I said the indirect bankruptcy cost rate can range from 0 to 30%, and that's on top of a direct cost of 10%. I'm putting Disney right in the middle at about a 15% indirect bankruptcy cost. Add the 10% direct, that's 25%. 25% of firm value, 137,839. So I take 0.66% of that bankruptcy cost, I come up with 227 million. So here's what I'm doing. I'm saying if I don't have the debt, I'd lose the tax benefit, but I wouldn't have the bankruptcy cost. My unlevered firm value is 132.3 billion. So I'm ready to do the APV approach for Disney. At every debt ratio, I compute my unlevered firm value. It's always the same. At every debt ratio, I compute my dollar debt. This is exactly the debt you saw when you did your original cost of capital. So it's 10% of the firm value, 20%. I multiply the dollar debt by the tax rate. And the only thing notice about the tax rate is it after 60%, you notice it drops to 32.6 and 36.8. Remember what made that happen? My interest expenses exceeded my operating income and I lost tax benefits. So my tax benefit is debt times the tax rate. I'm using the shortcut. At every level of debt, I compute my rating. So as long as I'm AAA rated, my probability of default is only 0.07%. That comes from this table. As my rating drops to AA, single A, B minus, C, C, double C, my probability of default climbs. My expected bankruptcy cost is the probability of default times the value of the firm times 25%, which is my bankruptcy cost. So notice my bankruptcy cost climb. So here's my levered value firm, levered value computed. I start with the unlevered firm value. I add the tax benefits, subtract out the expected bankruptcy cost, I get the value of the levered firm. The last column, you get that value. What's my objective? Maximize value. And for Disney, that happens at 40% debt. This is pure coincidence that it's exactly the same optimal debt ratio I had with the cost of capital approach. Because for most companies, you get a different optimal, not hugely different, but slightly different. Because it's very sensitive to that bankruptcy cost being 25% of value. In fact, for Disney, if I made it 40% of value, the optimal would have been somewhere around 20% debt. So that's the APV approach, which brings me to my last approach for computing optimals. And this is the approach that most companies use. They will never admit to it. What they do is they look at other companies in the sector and they see what debt ratios they have and they try to stay as close as they can to the industry average. They do this not just on debt, they do it on dividends, they do it on investing, they do it on buybacks. Me tooism is very strong in corporate finance. And you know why they do it? Because if things go wrong then, they can say, look, don't pick on me. We all made the same mistake. So I'm going to accept the fact that in most companies, no CFOs are interested in what the industry average is, but I will push this one step further. Why are we just looking at the average? If I'm looking at Disney and I look at the entertainment industry average, I could get an average debt ratio for the entertainment industry, but Disney is much bigger than those companies, much safer, more diversified. Shouldn't their debt ratio be higher than the average? So I'm going to argue for a more finessed approach where I look at the industry, at the other companies in the sector, but rather than go to the average, I go to a number that reflects my difference as a company. So let's see what the industry averages look like for my companies. For all four of my companies, I got a very convenient finding, and I'll explain what I mean by convenient. I computed four measures of the debt ratio, a book value and a market value, gross debt ratio and a net debt ratio. Net debt, remember, I net out cash. On every measure, Disney has more debt than the entertainment sector. I'm sorry, less debt than the entertainment sector. You know why this is convenient? What did I find for them when I did the cost of capital approach? That they were under levered. Their debt ratio was 11.6%. Their optimal was 40. If the CFO says, well, I'm not going to do it because I'm afraid that I look strange, I'm going to point out that even compared to the industry average, Disney has too little debt. It'll allow me to sell my pitch that they have too little debt because the industry average is higher than their actuals. For Vale, every measure of debt is higher than the industry average, which actually is good for me as well because when I did their optimal, they were slightly overlevered. This backs up that proposition. They have too much debt. Tata Motors, on every measure of debt, has more debt than the industry average. Again, backs up my case that Tata Motors is too much debt, should reduce debt. And Baidu, if you look at every debt ratio, on a book debt ratio basis, In fact, Baidu is actually a little more levered than the typical online advertising company. So if I were pushing Baidu, I'd actually push them away from my Optimum because my Optimum is 10%. But they're behaving like the rest of the sector. They should have even less debt than they actually have because their debt ratio looks a little higher than the industry average. Not hugely high, but a little higher. So one of the ways you can use industry average is just compare your company to the industry average, see whether it confirms what you found with the cost of capital approach. But I'll go one step further. I'm going to argue that there are statistical tools I can use to not just look at the average, but look at why debt ratios are different across companies in my sector. Let me explain. When I look across automobile companies, every automobile company doesn't have the same debt ratios. Some have higher, some have lower. What if I could look to see why the companies with high debt ratios had higher debt ratios and why the companies that borrowed less had less? And here's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to look at the debt ratios of these companies and throw in variables that I think might explain why they have the debt ratios that they do. Tax rate. High tax rates should lead to high debt ratios. Earnings variability. The more uncertain you're about earnings, the less you should borrow. And EBITDA. The more cash flow you can generate as a company, the higher the debt ratio. I run this regression. I check it to see whether it's statistically significant with the t-statistics and how good it is at predicting the debt ratio. Then I plug the values for my company into the regression. I'll get a predicted debt ratio for my company. I can compare the actual debt ratio to that predicted debt ratio. It's going to give me a measure of whether my company is too little or too much debt, given how the rest of the sectors behave. Sounds too abstract, right? Let's try this on Tata Motors. I took 56 global auto companies. I took their debt ratios and ran a regression across these 56 companies on tax rate, EBITDA to enterprise value, and CapEx to enterprise value. If you've never run a regression, it's almost magical in today's day and age how you do it. You put the sample of 56 companies, hit the regression button, and the output comes out with these coefficients on it. You say, what am I going to do with this? First, check the R-squared, 21%. Not bad, but it'll mean that you're, if not great either, but it is what it is, given the data. It does mean that your predicted value is going to have a little noise in it, a range on it, but I can still plug in the numbers for Tata Motors into this regression. What I get as a predicted debt ratio is about 18.5%. You say, what does that mean? Given how global automobile companies are setting debt ratios, I would expect Tata Motors' debt ratio to be 18.5%. Their actual debt ratio is 29%. Looks like they're overlevered. That actually confirms what we found with the cost of capital approach. But this is a finessed relative analysis where you're looking at other companies in the sector but controlling for differences. Once I did that, I said, why stop at the sector? Why not look at every company in the market? So I ran a regression of debt ratios against variables that I thought mattered across the entire market using companies in the US. So ETR is the effective tax rate. Institutional holdings, the percent of shares held by institutions to capture the fact that if institutions hold a lot of shares, maybe I need more discipline from debt. The coefficient of variation in operating income tells me how variable operating income is and how much cash flow I have is captured with the EBITDA variable. I even threw the growth in. I ran the regression. I'll give you the disappointing news first. The R squared is only 8%. The T statistics, though, are all significant. That is actually one of the ironies in regressions. People focus on the R squared. They forget that you can have a regression with predictive power, even though the range might be wide, because the T statistics give you a measure of statistics. So all of these variables are significant. I have a regression for the entire market. You say, what are you going to do with it? I took the numbers for Disney in 2014 and plugged them into the regression. Okay? So Disney's tax rates, its revenue growth. There's my regression equation. I plug it in, I get a predicted debt ratio of about 18.86%. You say, what does this tell me? You know what it tells you? Given how other US companies are setting debt ratios in 2014, Disney's debt ratio should be 18.86%. They were actually at 11.6%. They look under 11. You're saying, why is this optimal different from the 40% we compute in the cost of capital approach? Because it asks a different question. Say, given how other companies are borrowing money, maybe they don't borrow as much money as the cost of capital approach requires them to. So in summary, we've looked at multiple approaches for coming up with the optimum. And we're getting some consensus, right? For Disney, the actual debt ratio is 11.6%. We used the cost of capital approach and got 40. The operating income approach, we didn't even try, so skip it. The enhanced cost of capital approach was 40. APV approach was 40. When I looked at the industry, the regression of just entertainment companies was 28.5%. Even with the market regression was 18.86%. You say the optimals are all different. They are. But my actual is less than every one of those optimals. My conclusion is Disney is definitely under-levered. Vivale got 35.48, and there I got a mixed effect, depending on whether I use the cost of capital approach or the APV approach. It looks either slightly over-levered or perhaps correctly levered. Tata Motors, the actual debt ratio is 29%, and they look over-levered relative to every approach. And Baidu had a 5% debt ratio, and they look slightly under-levered using three approaches, but over-levered relative to the sector. What I would recommend for your company is use the cost of capital approach and compare to the industry. Use at least two approaches. See if you can get some sense of direction on what the company should be doing. Because you want to at least get a measure of whether your company is correctly levered, under-levered, or over-levered before we move to the next phase of what we're going to do in this class. It's been a long session. We've covered a lot of stuff. I hope you get a chance to review the slides before next Monday when we'll be live again. And I will double up on office hours next week since I haven't had my office hours this week. So you'll have plenty of chances after you've reviewed the slides to ask the questions that you want to. But I'll keep hitting you with follow-ups to these sessions. Thank you very much. And I hope you have a good day.